any mistakes or typos and so forth. I think I tried to get everything as much as possible to get it right. So as a way of introduction, yesterday I spoke about symmetries and the role of symmetries. This has really been the theme of my N-year career. I don't want to say what N is, pretty large. And just this morning we had another talk about the role of symmetries, which are actually at least superficially similar to the kind of symmetries I'll be talking about here. These are symmetries that have another vector index. So this is a global symmetry. Now, my motivation for studying this topic came from the topic of fractons. I've been really baffled by the idea of fractons. And after spending several months, close to a year now, trying to learn it, I think I've only scratched the surface of what's out there. So I'm really an outsider. I'm not an expert in fractons. But I did try to decipher some of that literature, and I'd like to share these things, my understanding with you. And as I said before, whenever I'm confused about a problem in physics, and this is a good lesson for many of you to take away from this talk, when confused, go after the symmetry. Because the symmetry is usually unambiguous, it's not getting contaminated by all sorts of complicated dynamical issues and so forth. It's a lot cleaner, so you should just go after the symmetry. And I wanted to understand the kind of symmetries that are being discussed in the context of fractons. Now, since I don't know anything about fractons, I have no idea whether what I'll be talking about has any relevance to fractons. I should say that from the beginning. What is true is that I'll exhibit very peculiar global symmetries that I have not seen before in quantum systems. They all almost beg the question, these are very nice symmetries, but is there a physical system that actually realizes them? And I'll present examples, and as you will see, the examples are very, very peculiar. These are not examples that you normally study in your quantum field theory courses. And I hope that, okay, so it might be that I'm totally barking up the wrong tree, and it might be that these peculiarities that I will present are really essential to the field, and I just leave it at that. I don't know. And since this is a small group, I really encourage you to ask many questions. If you don't ask questions, I threaten you that I will finish before the end. So we'll go after the global symmetries, and specifically I'll be interested in global symmetries that carry another index, a vector index. Normally, when you have a global symmetry, there is a charge, and the charge is a scalar under rotation. And this would be a symmetry that is a charge, is a vector. Have we ever seen anything like this before? Yes, obviously we did. The momentum is a global symmetry, is a charge, and the charge carries an index I. And this is a good place to explain my notation. I, j, k, and so forth will be spatial indices. I'm not going to assume Lorentz invariants. I am going to assume spatial Euclidean invariants, rotations and translations. But I'll keep track of the indices such that we can put the system in curved space, but not necessarily in curved space-time. So these are the rules of the game. If you don't like them, you're entitled to play another game. But no relativity. So the system is not relativistic. I separate.
It's not relativistic. The mean is not necessarily symmetric.
That's correct. But I'm just reminding people of another example in which the current is symmetric. Yeah. And the reason I bring it up here is that we're going to write network currents. So the whole talk will be network currents, and they're going to have indices. And as you will see, whether the indices are symmetric or anti-symmetric, this will turn out to be absolutely crucial to what I say. So I remind people that this is something we've seen before. In a relativistic system, there is a PI. This is a charge that has a vector index. And then the network current T mu nu is a symmetric tensor. And then we can generalize it in various ways. So the indices mu and nu, I'll use that, even though the system will not be relativistic, I'll use it as a shorthand for space-time indices, because sometimes it's more convenient to use space-time notation. But throughout most of the talk, I will have only non-relativistic symmetry. Another example that I will review later is the example of a one-form symmetry, a one-form global symmetry, and I'll review it soon. And this is another example which will be a good place. We'll review it, and that would be kind of the jumping board for the rest of the discussion. And what I'll do in the later in the talk, I will present three kinds of symmetries. Every one of them is a generalization of the previous one. The first will be the relativistic one-form symmetry, and then I'll present one generalization of it, and then I'll generalize it even further. And for every one of these symmetries, I will present first a large class of examples. We'll present this will be kind of a hierarchical structure that the field theory, I'll present examples of field theories that realize them, and the field theories will gradually become more and more generic. So that will allow the symmetry will kind of be intuitively smaller, and as a result, I can add more terms in the examples. And in any one of the examples, I'll present the conserved currents. So I'm limiting myself to U1 symmetries, no discrete symmetry, but continuous ones. This is one limitation. I believe that many of the things I say here, except the current, of course, carry over to discrete symmetries, and you will see some what the charges are, so that would be clear. Now, from this introduction, I think you have no idea what I'm going to talk about. And so the rest of the talk will just give details of that. And I would also want to emphasize that throughout this exploration, although I was confused and it took me a long time to understand it and so forth, the way I'll present it, it will almost be following a textbook analysis. So I will do very, very standard conservative steps using well-established rules, and I'll just follow my nose with these rules and see where it takes me. So let's start with a review of the relativistic one-form symmetry. There's a long history of the subject. The presentation I will follow here is the one that originated in this paper with one of the authors in the audience, but he's not paying attention now. John, pay attention. And the symmetry is characterized by a current. This is a relativistic system. It has two indices, mu and u. It's anti-symmetric. So this notation means that the indices are anti-symmetric. And the derivative with respect to mu is zero. And because of this equation, we can form charges. These are objects integrated over a codimension 2 manifold in space-time, C. So I wrote it like that. We can write it with an epsilon tensor. There are various ways of writing it. In this case, form notation is the best. And this equation has two consequences. This object is independent of small deformations of C. And the small deformations could be either sliding the whole thing in time, and that means that the charge is conserved, and small spatial deformations. So even if I put C at fixed time, as is more natural in a non-relativistic system, this is an operator acting at fixed time, I can make small deformations of the spatial manifold C, and that does not affect the answer. Simply because small deformations, I will just use the equation here, so that the difference between them is a total derivative, it integrates to zero. So, but we want to study the system as a non-relativistic system, so I'm going to take the same equation I had before and write it in non-relativistic terms. So I break it to two equations, one of them with the index, the upper index j, is a spatial index, and then the equation looks like that. And the other is when the upper index j is here, it's so the index j here would be zero, then we have this equation. So the relativistic equation splits into two equations. And in a relativistically invariant theory, these two equations are related to each other by the Lorentz transformations. But in a non-relativistic system, these are two separate equations. And that would be absolutely crucial for us. And everything I said before is still true because I did nothing but rewrite the previous discussion in new notation. In fact, in older notation, in the non-relativistic notation. So what are the charges? So at fixed time, we have charges. And the charges are integrated over C, which is codimension 1 in space, unlike ordinary charges, which are integrated over all of space. And it is topological for the same reason it was topological before. Topological in the sense that we can change C a little bit in space, and that does not affect the answer. Now, let's take an example that we will follow throughout the talk. And the example will be Maxwell theory. So Maxwell theory is based on the U1 gauge field. And this is the field strength, this is the electric field, and this is the magnetic field. And these two equations are the equation of motion of AI, and the other is the equation of motion of A0. So I called this object G before, DIJI0, I called it G, just pulled it, looks like I just gave it a name. But now the reason for the letter G makes sense, because in the example of a U1 gauge theory, this equation is Gauss law. In general, this is an abstract quantity associated with the symmetry. But in the context of Maxwell theory, this equation is Gauss law, and this is one of the field equations. So the equation of motion of AJ gives us the conservation equation, and the equation of motion of A0 gives us Gauss law. And the various things we talked about before have a completely standard physical meaning. Q of C is the electric flux through C. We just take, we'll integrate the current. The current is the electric field. You integrate it over codimension 1, so it's an integral over in 4 dimensions, it would be a surface. And this is the electric flux, and we all know that the electric flux through a surface is conserved. And we also know that this is a pure Maxwell theory, there are no charges. So if I make small deformations of C, the answer doesn't change. So as a symmetry, we can always ask ourselves, what are the charged operators? Which operator carries charge under the symmetry? And here it's the Wilson line. It's either a Wilson line, or we could say there are external probe charges that we add to the system, and they carry charge under that one-form global symmetry. There's also a magnetic symmetry, but we're not going to discuss it here. I'd like to describe the same thing in the context of lattice gauge theory, mostly for the sake of those people who don't know lattice gauge theory. So most high-energy physicists these days don't know lattice gauge theory if they're condensed matter. How many people of you are condensed matter physicists, at least by a large fraction? So you fall asleep before the next few slides. So what is a U1 lattice gauge theory? So we have a lattice. It has plaquettes P, links L, and sites S. And actually, I shouldn't have asked this question because I don't like putting people in boxes. So I think we are all theoretical physicists. We just have more experience in one set of questions than in others, or in one set of techniques than in others, and we should all be like a big family, happy family. So we pick A0 equals 0 gauge, and then there is a Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian has degrees of freedom. The degrees of freedom are U1 elements on the links. I denote them by UL. And they have conjugate momenta EL, which is roughly the electric field, also living on the links. And the Hamiltonian is this. They are plaquettes elements. This UP is the product of U link around the plaquette, all the links around the plaquette P. And this is an oriented product, so you have to pick orientation. And then it's either U or U dagger as you go around. And writing it explicitly is usually more painful than saying it in words. And this is the sum of the electric field. So in continuum notation, this is E square, and this is B square. But this is the lattice version of it. And Gauss law is the statement that the oriented sum of all the electric fields coming from a given site is 0. In continuum notation, this is the statement that the divergence of E is 0. On the lattice, it's E of this minus the E of that plus E of this minus the E of that, et cetera. All three spatial directions has to be imposed. So the Hilbert space is the big Hilbert space. We diagonalize, say, E. And out of all this big Hilbert space, we constrain the system to satisfy Gauss law. Namely, the sum of the E's should be 0. And this system has an electric one-form symmetry. So unlike the continuum system, as it says, has also a magnetic one-form symmetry. The lattice system does not have the magnetic symmetry, but it does have the electric one-form symmetry. And the electric one-form symmetry is, as we are saying, three spatial dimensions. We consider a surface C, just as in the continuum. The surface crosses some links. It goes through the lattice and it crosses some links. And now I'm taking the oriented sum of the electric field through all the links that are being pierced by the surface. In continuum notation, this is the integral of E perpendicular to the surface. And on the lattice, we just go around and we pick E or minus E. This is an operator. And it's easy to check that this operator commutes with the Hamiltonian. It clearly commutes with this because all the E's commute. And it commutes with this because every plaquette is cut twice. Because as the surface goes through the plaquette, it cuts it either twice or four times or none at all. Cuts it an even number of times. And therefore, this is a conserved, this commutes with the Hamiltonian. And therefore, it's conserved. And it's also topological, just as in the continuum, because if we move the surface a little bit, it will just, we'll have the same answer because of Gauss' law. So Gauss' law guarantees that as we move the surface a little bit and we cross some sites as we move the surface, the difference would be some linear combination of E's. But the linear combination of E's vanishes because of Gauss' law. So this is what we would expect in the on the lattice. So I presented the symmetry. I presented the symmetry in the continuum. And I presented the symmetry on the lattice. Any questions so far? I really emphasize that up to this point, I did not say anything that was not known several years ago. There's nothing so far that is new. Any questions so far? This is the time to ask questions, because from this point on, it's going to be new and, and getting more technical.
So how do I understand the relation between one-form symmetry in one higher dimension and zero-form symmetry in
Excellent. So if you compactify the system on a circle, you can do that in any number of dimensions. You compactify the system on a circle, then the component of the symmetry with the index, the vector index, in the direction that you compactify becomes an ordinary symmetry in the non-compact dimensions. And the components of the vector symmetry in higher dimensions with the indexes, with the index pointing in the non-compact dimension, remains a one-form global symmetry. So it splits under compactification to a zero-form symmetry and a one-form symmetry. Thank you for the question. Oh, we should start with the PsI students and then the graduate students. And then people who don't belong here will ask the most painful questions. Is it recorded? So let's generalize that. So the first generalization is kind of obvious. We had these two equations. By splitting the relativistic system, writing it in non-relativistic terms. So this is a conservation equation. So if we want to have a symmetry, we should retain the conservation equation. But the first generalization we might think about is let's forget this equation, the second one. So let's forget G equals zero. So we have a current. So what's the cast of characters? We have one component of the current, J0i. J0j is this one. And another one, spatial component, Jij. It's anti-symmetric. And it satisfies this conservation equation. But we're not going to impose G equals zero. This is kind of an obvious thing, right? You have two equations. Relativity relates them. If you want a non-relativistic system, let's throw away one of them. So that's
totally random.
By this, you can think of many things. But this is first a natural thing to do. But soon you will see that there are well-established, well-studied systems that have exactly this global symmetry. So before we continue, we have this equation. We don't impose it. But let's take the derivative of G with respect to time. So the time derivative of G is this. So I just hit it by that. And then I use the first equation. And since this is anti-symmetric in I and J, I get zero. So this is elementary algebra. So elementary algebra tells me that even though I did not impose this equation, G equals zero, so di, ji, zero is not, I don't impose it, it's zero, it is conserved. And it is conserved at every point. So that already tells you something quite unusual. We have a conserved global charge at every point in space. Every point in space has its own conserved charge because the derivative of G with respect to time is zero. So it's conserved at every point. But unlike the previous system, it's not zero. So we have a conserved charge. The previous system was such that there was a conserved charge and we imposed the charge as zero. But now we don't impose the charge as zero. So what can we do? The conserved charges, as before, are the surface integrals, or codimension one manifold J. And yeah, so these are the conserved charges. And you can check that it's conserved because it's independent of time. However, in order to prove that it's topological, I had to use this equation. But that's no longer true. So as I go to this system, the non-relativistic one-form symmetry, I gave it the name non-relativistic one-form symmetry because it's the same as the one-form symmetry except that I remove this condition that comes from relativity. So Q is not topological. Small changes of C change the answer. So let's explore it. And furthermore, I can now study a cruder charge, which is an integral over C. So we had that for every surface C, but I can also integrate it over all of space. So this is an integral over all of space of the same time component. It does not contain more information than this, because I simply integrate that over all possible surfaces. So at the moment, it looks like, why should I bother even defining this quantity? This will become clear soon. Now, if we have these two charges, we can ask, what are the charged objects? So before we had lines, the charged objects were line, and no point operator was charged under the one-form global symmetry. That's no longer the case now. Now we can have local operators that carry charge under that symmetry, simply because it's not topological. Let's understand that a little better. So we had this equation. This was the defining equation of the symmetry. And now we look at the time derivative, and we learn that this is zero. And these are the conserved charges. I'd like to argue that these two conserved charges are closely related. Because imagine we take a codimensional one manifold in space C, which is the boundary of M. For example, take a point in space surrounded by a little ball. So there's a little sphere around it. And imagine C is the sphere around that point. So it's the boundary of a little ball M. And then this object can be written as an integral over the space in the ball. And this is our g. So before g was zero, now g is not zero, but it is conserved. So if I change the boundary a little bit and make m a little bit bigger, q changes. Q becomes different because I integrate over a bigger ball, but it's still conserved. Conversely, if I make c smaller, I see that this thing leads to this conservation. So the fact that g at the point is time independent is just a special case of this q of c by making c sufficiently small. But this information, the conservation of q, contains more information because there could be manifolds c that are not the boundary of anything. For example, I've put the system on the torus and it's the xy plane of the torus. It's not the boundary of anything. So in words, the conservation of q implies the conservation of g. This is kind of the local version of it. This is very much like, we'll soon see examples, but this is very much like Maxwell's equations in their integral form and in their differential form. But the conservation of q contains more information because c might not be a boundary. I've already said it before. Now, so far, it looked like, why am I doing this? I had a nice relativistic symmetry. I wrote it in non-relativistic terms. I said, well, we need to generalize it. Let's throw away one of the equations. That's kind of a natural generalization. But is there any system that we know of that exhibits this system, that exhibits this symmetry? These are really two questions. First, is there any realization of this? And second, is there any realization that we know about and was studied for other purposes that has that symmetry? So the answer to both is yes. So let me present an example. So let's take the same lattice gauge theory that we had before and not impose Gauss' law. This sounds like in the right direction because the equation that we want to throw away was g equals zero, the equation of Gauss' law. And this was done by Kitaev, and there's a lot of follow-up on that. He did it for Z2, but this is for U1. It's essentially the same idea. So this is the Hamiltonian that we had before, the sum over the plaquettes, and then the sum over the links with E square. And I'm adding to the Hamiltonian the sum over all the sides of the lattice of this divergence E square. So what does it mean? I don't impose Gauss' law. I just write this Hamiltonian, never heard of gauge symmetry. The U's are U1 elements. The E are their conjugate momenta. I don't impose Gauss' law. So this is some Hamiltonian. And what this term does is that it says that if divergence E is zero, the energy is low. If divergence E is non-zero, the energy is higher. So the low-lying states of this Hamiltonian are very much like the low-lying states of the original system. So instead, the words that are being used in the literature is that instead of imposing Gauss' law by hand as a constraint on the Hilbert space, we impose Gauss' law energetically. Namely, you embed the system in a bigger Hilbert space that does not satisfy Gauss' law, but we don't look at the subspace that includes, that satisfies Gauss' law, but we look at the big space and we put a Hamiltonian that splits the states into those that satisfy Gauss' law and those that don't. So there's huge literature on this subject. And there's a physical interpretation of it. What does it mean that divergence E is not zero? If divergence E is not zero, it means that there's charged matter in the problem, because divergence E equals rho. Some of you are sufficiently young that you remember your elementary electrodynamics. I had to refresh my memory. So we interpret this system as a U1 gauge theory, which has electrically charged particles in the system. However, the electrically charged particles are very, very heavy. They are so heavy that I did not include the degrees of freedom in the Hamiltonian. So they are as heavy in continuum language as the UV cutoff, and in lattice language, they're as heavy as the inverse lattice spacing. So at the scale of the lattice, they are heavy charged particles, but their dynamics is quite limited, and we'll soon see that in more detail. But since they are there, they are operators in the theory that move, kill an electric charge here and create an electric charge there, and therefore Gauss' law is not satisfied as an operator. Divergence E is not zero because there could be an operator on the right-hand side. And what do we see here? That this is still conserved, as I said before. G is still conserved. And the electric flux is conserved but not topological. To see that, you can just commute either this thing or this thing with the Hamiltonian. This is both are constructed only out of E, so it commutes with this and commutes with this. And it does not, here we have to work a little bit harder, the Plaquette terms, but again, the same argument I said before applies. As I commute this with that, I always get an even number of terms that contribute, and they cancel in pairs. And as I said, in the continuum, it's still true on the lattice. This is conserved, and this contains more information as that, because if C is a surface that surrounds one site, then this equation is the same as that equation. So things work and make sense. And this system was analyzed by many people in the language very close to the one I've been using here. I found these two papers. I'm sure there are many others. And this system, this actually has this non-relativistic one-form symmetry. So I looked up at the literature and I consulted with some of the authors here whether that symmetry was actually noticed. So people study these systems a lot. So people in condensed matter, people in the audience must have heard of the toric code. So the toric code has that symmetry. But as far as I know, nobody quite spelled out, look, just take this Hamiltonian, forget where it came from. It has more symmetry that is being used in the applications. Of course, we can add terms to the Hamiltonian that break the symmetry, but that's true with every symmetry. But if we just take it at face value, it has that peculiar symmetry that I mentioned. So this is on the lattice. I'd like to move to the continuum and give a continuum field theory description of the same phenomenon. Can we find a continuum field theory that exhibits exactly the same phenomenon? So we are going to imitate what's going on the lattice. So this is the equation we would like to reproduce as a symmetry. Could you move a little bit? Because, yeah, thank you. So we take the U1 gauge symmetry, and we would like to couple it to some matter system. That was also the intuition behind not imposing Gauss' law explicitly, but saying that it is imposed energetically. We say we have matter system. But the matter system has to be very special so that we have that special global symmetry. So we are going to retain this identification. So we'd like to go after a system that has, like to find a system that has that operator equation. So like we have a U1 gauge theory. A good place to start is this. This is what we had before. And now I would like to change the system a little bit such that we ruin the second equation. So imagine you have a matter theory some scalar field or whatever, you fermions, whatever you want, that has an operator O, such that the divergence of O, O with respect to time, is zero. So I don't even commit myself to what this theory is. You have a theory that has a conserved charge O at every point in space. I'll soon write examples of continuum field theories that exhibit that. But this is enough for me to write a continuum field theory that has that global symmetry. So this will essentially be my G, because G has to be such that it's non-zero, but its derivative with respect to time is zero. So if I have such an operator O, I can construct a current in the matter theory whose zeroth component is O, and its spatial component is zero. So this is a conserved current. It's conserved trivially, because the path associated with this spatial component vanishes, and the path in time is conserved because of this equation. And now I couple it minimally to electromagnetism. So we had before F squared. This was in our previous example. L0 is the Lagrangian of the matter theory that I didn't even specify. And how do I couple things minimally? All right, a gauge field times the current. This is a textbook way of coupling system to a gauge field. So I say, consider this Lagrangian. And I suppress coefficients because otherwise it would clutter the equations. And if I do that, so L0 is the matter Lagrangian, you can check that this is gauge invariant. This is gauge invariant on its own. This is gauge invariant. And here we get the derivative of, under gauge transformation, it's the derivative of A0 with respect, the derivative of the gauge parameter with respect to time when I integrate by parts and use this equation to get that it's gauge invariant. And now we can look at the equations of motion, and very much like before, the derivative, the equation of motion of Aj gives me this equation, this identification. The equation of motion of A0 gives us the equation for G. So I've just exhibited a large class of matter systems that have that energetically imposed Gauss law. And the only thing now we could ask is, can I provide a more explicit example of a system, a matter system, that has this condition? And that's relatively easy. But before we do that, let me make one more comment about this system. So the idea is, I'm going from the more abstract to the more concrete. So we discussed the symmetries in general. Then I said, here is a large class. I don't even tell you what the matter system is. Some matter system, and it does what it does. But I can prove a lot of properties of it. I can find a lot of its properties without even telling you what it is. Yes?
Sorry. So how do I distinguish the situation from having a matter density in general, which too would violate the Gauss law in this way? Is it just that the continuity equation for this matter density and the current is not being satisfied here?
Or? No, so what you really want is a matter system such that rho is independent of time. If you have a generic random matter system, rho will depend on time, and there would also be current, right. And the equation will be more general, and I'm not going to have this symmetry. In order to have this special symmetry, I need the matter to be very special, and specifically I need the charge density rho to be non-zero but independent of time. And it's not, well, this system with the energetically imposed Gauss law has these properties, so I ought to find some continuum Lagrangians that do that so that I can see what the charges are. But I say that independent of what the system is, it has many conservation equations, and conservation that comes from putting an arbitrary function of xi in front of O. So O is a time-independent operator. And since this is a time-independent, and C depends only on space, this is also a conserved charge. So the matter system on its own already has many conserved charges. And if you wish, the charge density O is conserved, and the dipole moment is conserved, and the quadrupole moment is conserved, all these moments are conserved, and they're lumped into this thing. And that's true for every C of xi. And that really means that the charge matter is not mobile. And as you said, so we have charge density, which is constant. So charges cannot move. Charges are pinned. So we started with some system with some charge distribution. The charges are pinned. And then the charges can we have operators that allow us to move a charge from one place to another, but the dynamics doesn't let me move the charges around. So that's the intuition behind that. And now I'd like to write a concrete example of a field theory that does the job. So here is a Lagrangian. I work in first order formalism in time. So I have a complex scalar field. This is the charge matter. And I have a one time derivative. This term is invariant under this symmetry, because the symmetry acts by multiplying phi by e to the I, arbitrary function of space, not time. There had been time argument here, we would say this is a gauge symmetry, but we have an arbitrary spatial function here, phi. And then we can write such a Lagrangian with higher order terms. And the key point, so first of all, this C cancels here in the phi bar phi and cancels here, it trivially cancels here and here. This is also invariant because this phase depends only on space. And there are many other terms you can write down that are invariant. The key point is that the standard spatial derivative term is missing. And it's missing in what in high energy physics is called in a natural way because I impose a symmetry that kills it. It's not invariant under the symmetry. And that's why it's a natural thing to do. But it means that the quadratic part of the Lagrangian is the generator, whatever you call it, non-invertible. And so, well, this is good news or bad news. This is a property of this system. And it has some of the features of fractals where the charges are not mobile. So we see that this, as I wanted to do, I wanted to get all this information from symmetries rather than saying by declaring the charges are not mobile. Yes?
If you quantize it, what happens?
This is a very interesting question, and I can discuss that if I have more time. So my paper has an appendix addressing precisely this question. What happens if you quantize this system? It's actually quite bizarre. But you see, there's really no obstacle in the sense that the quadratic part of the system is this. It's relatively easy. And then you can add various interactions. And the spectrum is quite bizarre. If you study the matter system on its own, but then you can ask what happens to the matter system when you couple it to electromagnetism, which I'm going to do on the next slide. And that I've not analyzed in a lot of detail. But for that, there's an appendix in my paper. If I have time at the end, which I doubt I will discuss. Yeah, there was a question here.
So for the case of fracton or just lattice models in general, so that feature of immobile particle or the emergent Gauss law, that's stable against adding some random perturbations?
Right? No, it's not. It's random. It's stable against random perturbations if the system is gapped and at low energies, this is true. But I can easily write here operators that violate it. For example, I can add this thing.
Sure.
If I add this thing, the charges become mobile.
Yeah, that's my
question. But also true in the lattice version, I can take the Gauss, the U1 lattice gauge theory that I had before, and add just the link variables. Since I don't impose gauge invariance, I can add just sum of the lattice of all the links of U-link, plus U-link dagger, whatever. I can add such terms, and then the symmetry is not there, and then the charges are not mobile. So the only novelty here is that whatever physical picture you have, charges mobile or not, and they're pinned or this or that, I describe everything in terms of symmetries. And I usually prefer that because the physical picture could be confusing. With the symmetries, here's an operator, check if it commutes with a Hamiltonian. And then I don't care, the dynamics could be very complicated. I just check whether something commutes or not. Any more questions?
There are many examples. I mean, just an example. There are many examples that have this property with the system.
Oh, yeah, no, that's the whole point. So I started first, there's a symmetry. I have one equation that I needed. And then of all these, you could say, well, maybe I'm talking about the empty set. So I showed one example. And there might be others. I'm sure there are others. But that's the one I picked. And I'm going to generalize it soon. So everything I said before is still true. This is an example of a matter system. So now let's read it backwards. This is a particular matter system that has this property, that has an operator O independent of time. And if I take this system and couple it to electromagnetism, I have an example of this non-relativistic symmetry. And you shouldn't be surprised because it's the same as the lattice system. So if you prefer the lattice clearly exists. And in the lattice, we clearly have the symmetry. You can check that these things commute. And this is just a continuum way of saying the same thing. So it's not some peculiarity of lattices. There are continuum systems that do that. The peculiarity in the continuum is that I have this funny-looking Lagrangian. But other than that, I just follow my nose. But I'd like to generalize it further. And I generalize it further as follows. We had this equation before. So this was our starting point. First, we had this equation. I and J were anti-symmetric, and there was another equation that I added. That was the relativistic system that was beaten to death. Then I throw away one of the equations. I and J remained anti-symmetric. And now I generalize it further, where I relax the condition that I and J are anti-symmetric. So I and J are arbitrary things. They could be symmetric or anti-symmetric, traceless or not traceless. I put an arbitrary tensor there. So now the derivative of g with respect to 0, so I just hit this thing with d0, so it's di ji. Now I use the equation and I write two derivative acting on j, but since it's no longer anti-symmetric, the derivative is not 0. So by generalizing it, I find that g, this object, is no longer conserved. So now this operator g, which in the examples was the charge density, is no longer conserved at every point. And we could ask, does that mean the charges are mobile? And I'm going to answer this question. So what are the conserved charges? Well, this is net a current. So if I take the zeroth component and integrate it over all of space, I should definitely get a conserved charge. This, however, is no longer conserved. So notice the hierarchy. In the first system, which was the relativistic one-form symmetry, G was zero. In the non-relativistic one, it was not zero, but it was independent of time. And now it even depends on time. So this is the hierarchy of cases that I have. And this is the conserved charge. So this is, I pulled that out of a hat. Question, can we find quantum field theories that exhibit that symmetry? So I could do it on the lattice. For lack of time, I will not explain that. In fact, Meng told me how to do it on the lattice, so he deserves full credit for this because I couldn't see it. So you can add terms to the Hamiltonian of this energetically imposed Gauss law that I wrote before that break this non-relativistic one-form symmetry to this one, but not break it completely. So charges can move, but in a more restricted way. It will soon see in the continuum. So how did we do it? So we would like to find continuum realizations of this system. So before, the symmetric component of J was zero, and we coupled it to matter system for which O was independent of time. That was the rule. It says once O is independent of time, I can run the story. And then I later presented concrete examples of that, and Jome pointed out correctly, there are many other examples in that class of theories. So now I'm going to add more interactions, consider something more general. So it's kind of straightforward. Imagine you have a matter system with an operator O, just as before, but its time derivative is not zero, but it's the second derivative of some Oij. This is an operator equation, and clearly Oij is symmetric in I and J. That's just because its defining equation depends only on the symmetrization. The anti-symmetric part drops out. So imagine we have such a matter system. And now I have a conserved current, conserved ordinary current. The zero component is the charge density, just as it was before. So this is exactly as before. And the spatial component of the metric is this object. So unlike the previous case, this was zero. Now it's not zero, but it's a total derivative. So this is the spatial component of the metric. But it's not as generic as it could have been because it's a total derivative. So it's more general than before. It's not zero, but it's not the most generic one that can be. And now, what does it mean that I couple it to electromagnetism? Well, it's exactly as before. I take L0, the Lagrangian of the matter. I add F square. This was standard, was before. And this is what's called minimal coupling. And I might need to add Siegel terms, and there are more subtleties, but basically, that's what I need to do. I assume you know what Siegel terms are. Who doesn't know what Siegel terms are? Don't raise your hand. I'm not going to explain it here. So just staring at this Lagrangian, it has a single global symmetry. This is it. So let me prove that this is a conserved current. This equation satisfies, this object satisfies this equation. The equation of motion with respect to Aj coming from this Lagrangian is this equation. And notice that the current has both an anti-symmetric piece and a symmetric piece from this O. So here is a Lagrangian, in fact, a large class of models that have that symmetry. And now, just as I did before, I'm going to present some general properties of this matter system and present a concrete example to make sure that I'm not talking about the empty set. So this is our defining equation. So we have a matter system that has operators O and Oij satisfying that. And this matter system has the following conserved charges. First, it has Q with J0 integrated over all of space. This is like ordinary charge. But this is also conserved. And you can check it by, you know, you put this thing, you differentiate with respect to time, you write it as a second derivative, you integrate one by parts, it kills the xi, then you can integrate it again by parts, and you learn that this is independent of time. You cannot put more x's because here we have only two derivatives. So if the defining equation has more derivatives here, you could have put more x's. And then we interpret it as follows. So the first one, we just say that this is a system that has a global U1, ordinary global U1 symmetry that, to which we're going to couple, or for which to which we coupled before the U1 gauge field. So that's an ordinary U1. And this is like a dipole symmetry. So this system, before we coupled it to gauge field, has an ordinary monopole symmetry, carries charge, kind of ordinary U1, and it has a conserved dipole charge. This is the charge. And so this is the interpretation of it. And then what did we do? We gauge it. So we had two symmetries. We gauge that one, and we are left only with that one. So if we gauge the first one, we are left only with the symmetry whose charge is a vector, and indeed we have this equation. Now, here is a very crucial point, which for some reason caused a lot of confusion in the literature. So many of the things I've been saying here have a counterpart in the existing literature, but they are not presented the way I presented here. So this is my take on the literature, and I'll soon give references to what people say so that you know what are the related things. Now, notice this defining equation is completely local. This is a local equation, and therefore I can put it on every spatial manifold. I don't have to put it on RD. Space could be a torus. Space could even be a sphere. There might even be curvature. So the derivatives will have to be covariant derivatives and so forth, but this is a local equation. This is absolutely crucial because this means that everything I say is true on every spatial geometry. This contradicts claims in the literature. Notice that this is not true for the charges. So when I describe the charge, I had to put an xj here, but that makes sense only on RD. So imagine space was a torus. If space is a torus and we have that symmetry with xj, this is not well defined. So it's not well defined. I say, oh, let's exponentiate it. If we exponentiate it, it will make sense only with specific coefficients. So I'm not going to have a U1 symmetry of dipoles. And in fact, you see this claim in the literature. Yet, I claim that we have all the consequences of this dipole symmetry because they follow from this differential equation, which is a local condition. So I have a local condition that contains the information that on RD tells us that there's a conserved dipole charge, but exists on every manifold. Have we seen such a thing before? Of course. The energy momentum tensor is considered a relativistic system with a conserved symmetric energy momentum tensor. It has consequences locally. And the system can be put on many different manifolds, compact, non-compact, curvature, etc. Now, if we are on RD, we have translation symmetry and rotation symmetry, maybe even boost. If we are on a torus, we do not have rotation symmetry. And indeed, when you write the charges, the momentum is an integral over space, and the rotation thing has an explicit x there. And that's violated. Now, What's more fundamental? The fundamental thing is not that we have Poincaré symmetry on is a property of the system. This is a property on RD. Put it on different manifolds, the symmetry is not there. But the conserved energy momentum tensor is there on every manifold. So that's more fundamental. The analogous thing here is that the crucial equation is this one. That's what I have instead of a symmetry. And on RD, it has as a consequence the dipole symmetry. Now, after we coupled it to a U1 gauge field, we wrote the currents. We wrote this thing before. But now there is no explicit X, which is, again, a good sign. No explicit X telling us that the system does not have the monopole symmetry, but it does have the dipole symmetry. This is the current. And it satisfies the standard equations that I had before. Now, these are the properties of this system in general for any O. And Jomo will tell me that you can find many examples that have that. This is, as long as I have this equation, I can run the show. And there are many examples, but I would like to write a very concrete one. And this is one that was studied by Pretko. So he didn't present it in this way, but I will present it here. So here is a Lagrangian. So the first row is what we had before. And now we would like to change things a little bit. We'd like to add more terms so that this Oij is not zero. So I'm just adding a term, and you can check that this equation is satisfied. It's straightforward, but it's not manifest. And we can even find, so the standard kinetic term is absent, just as before. And the new term breaks this symmetry with arbitrary phase, arbitrary spatial dependent phase, the one that has only a linear thing in the exponent. And you can check that this thing is invariant. And indeed, O is phi square. And Oij starts as phi to the fourth, delta ij plus higher order terms. The higher order terms can even lead to traceless symmetric tensor. And so this Lagrangian has two such operators satisfying this equation. So if we couple it to a U1 gauge field, the first symmetry, the monopole symmetry, is gauged. Therefore, it's no longer a global symmetry, but the dipole symmetry remains. So let me summarize the symmetries. This was our basic equation. And in the vector symmetry, the most generic one, Jij is not restricted. And therefore, we have these charges, Qj, integral over space. Then there was a more special one where we restrict the indices here to be anti-symmetric. So this is it. And now we have also codimension one charges, but they're conserved but not topological. And then we also add another equation, this one, and now the codimension one manifolds are, the codimension one manifold is topological. So the answer is topological with respect to that. So I'm going to spend a few more slides discussing now, just for completeness, what happens if we gauge this symmetry. We have a global symmetry. It has a vector index. What happens if we take the system and we gauge that symmetry? That should be a straightforward thing. This is a little bit more technical. There will be lots and lots of indices. But I would like to flash it anyway just to show you that it's a completely straightforward. So if you just follow the logic of this talk, it's a completely straightforward thing to do, which interestingly connects to things in the literature. Although, again, they're not presented that way. So we start very generally. Imagine we have a system that has these operators. So we have only the vector symmetry. We don't have the monopole symmetry. So an example would be the last system would couple to a U1 gauge field. So what does it mean to couple a system to a background gauge field? So here we have, it's not really a global symmetry in the standard sense, because as we said, the global charges, the global symmetry acts in a funny way because of this explicit X. So what does it mean to gauge it? So a very lowbrow way of thinking about it is that for every operator here in the conservation equation, we add a source. So we call it B0j because it has 0 and j here. And we call this Aij because it couples to Aij. It has an anti-symmetric piece and a symmetric piece. And in the special case where Jij, the symmetric piece, is 0, we don't have to introduce S. And then we do minimal coupling. Minimal coupling tells us that if we have operators, we couple them to sources. So we had two operators participating in this continuity equation and this conservation equation. So we just multiply them by sources. And then, since we have this equation, if we change B0i by in this way, and we change Aij by a total derivative, we can integrate by parts. And when we integrate by parts, we use this equation to realize that the Lagrangian doesn't change. So if the Lagrangian doesn't change, it means that different values of the sources that are correlated in this fashion give us the same answer, and that's a statement of a gauge symmetry. Notice that there is no C0, unlike people are familiar. So in the case without Sij, so we have only B0j, an anti-symmetric piece here, this is something that has been studied a lot, both in math and in physics, in many different contexts. And here we add also a possible symmetric component. But unlike the standard literature, there is no C0 here. And Aij has no particular symmetry in I and J. So it's a very peculiar gauge field. This is not the gauge field that has been studied in the math literature, where people studied such anti-symmetric tensors in a lot of detail. But this is more general. It has both a symmetric and an anti-symmetric tensor. And also another interesting peculiarity is that in the math literature, when people study two-form gauge fields, the gauge parameter is C mu. It's not just a vector, but it is a U1 gauge field, so it can have patches. Here, we cannot have such patches. So this is just like an ordinary vector.
You don't require that the operator is invariant once you get this vector. You have higher order terms in B and A.
These are called Siegel terms.
Yes,
so people said before that they don't know what. No, I do impose. Okay. So I'll soon write examples that do that. But as long as I don't know what the J0 is,
yeah.
It might be that with fermions, I don't need to edit. With scalars, I do have to edit. So this answers your question of what's a Siegel. Siegel is a higher order term that I might need to add high order in the gauge field in order to maintain gauge invariance. So I said that I might need to do that. And I might or might not be able to do that. There might be obstructions. I'll show an example.
So, sorry, in this, like, CI is not a U1 gauge field. Is that like a choice that you made not to make it a U1 gauge field?
No, it follows from this. You see, everything follows. That's what I like about this. We had this differential equation. So we couple it to sources.
Yeah.
I just follow my nose. The differential equation tells me that I can perform such redefinitions,
right.
And the answer doesn't change. Now, question. What do we know about the CIs? So locally, these are vectors. Can they be a gauge field? In order for that to be a gauge field, I need it to be such that if I shift the CIs by a gauge transformation, the Bs don't change. So in the standard B mu nu, you say that B mu nu goes to B mu nu plus B mu lambda nu plus minus d nu lambda mu. And then you notice that if lambda mu is equal d mu of something, of little lambda, b doesn't change. And therefore, lambda is a U1 gauge field.
The whole point is that you don't have the second minus d, like the...
Well, I have the symmetric and the anti-symmetric part. So I can write it as transformation of the symmetric and the anti-symmetric part. Such things are mentioned in the physics literature, not from this perspective. I checked with some mathematicians, they're not explored much. Notice this is similar to a metric, the way a metric transforms, but when we do coordinate transformation, X also transforms, and here X doesn't transform. Okay, so this is some mathematical structure, I don't know what it is, it might be interesting or might not be. So we have that gauge symmetry. And now we can add kinetic terms for these gauge fields. So this is electric and magnetic-like fields. So you can check that these combinations are invariant under this gauge symmetry. So I can add kinetic terms. And now, just to connect to things that people know, imagine we have only B mu nu, only the anti-symmetric part, the symmetric part vanishes. Then people write H mu nu rho. There's a three-form field strength for the B mu nu field, which is very common in math, physics, etc. And that's nothing but the linear combination of these objects. So this is just kind of a sanity check that I'm not completely wrong. So let's implement that explicitly in the example we started with a matter system that has this defining equation. It has a U1 symmetry. We coupled it to a U1 gauge field. And through this current, this is something we had before. So we had this Lagrangian. This is a system we had before, and it had this conserved dipole symmetry. And now we just, so it has that global symmetry. So everything on this slide we already had before. And our goal now is to take this system with this global symmetry and gauge it. What happens when we gauge it? So we would like to gauge this remaining global symmetry. And I've already told you what to do. You take these currents, you multiply them by sources, and you follow your nodes from there. So we introduce these A's, as I said before, and you write minimal couplings. And here I've added the appropriate Siegel terms that are needed. And you can check that this Lagrangian, I'm kind of flashing because there's no way you can follow the algebra. And doing the algebra will be both boring and hard to follow. All I'm telling you is this Lagrangian, whatever L0 is, given that O and Oij satisfy the differential equation that I had, this Lagrangian has an ordinary U1 gauge symmetry and this new gauge symmetry. So let me show that more explicitly. The U1 gauge symmetry acts like this, and you can check that this Lagrangian is exactly invariant under that U1 gauge symmetry, that alpha is an ordinary U1 gauge transformation that acts on these gauge fields A in here and in here. But in addition, it also has a new gauge symmetry associated with a new symmetry, which acts as follows. It shifts AI by a constant, by the gauge parameter CI, and the B's transform as we said before. And the symmetric part was combined into this A. So I don't expect you to follow the details. I'm telling you that you can add kinetic terms, which are gauge invariant. You can check that they are gauge invariant. And now comes an interesting surprise. There's a Higgs mechanism taking place. See, the gauge symmetry is realized on AI nonlinearly. It shifts AI by a constant. This is a typical thing of a symmetry being realized nonlinearly, which is the hallmark of the Higgs mechanism. So if you just look at the spectrum with the kinetic terms constructed out of these guys, AI is Higgsed, which means it becomes massive. It combines with B0, with BI0 and BIJ, and we are left only with A0 and AIJ. So what are we left with is a matter system, some massive fields that we integrated, that can be integrated out, and this A0 and AIJ. And we can do that actually in one step. And by doing that, I connect to this set of papers and perhaps many others in the condensed matter literature. So we start with a system that some matter system that has these operators, O and Oij. I don't care what it is. I can take this specific example that I wrote down before with the scalar field, but I can take anything. And now I say, what does it mean to gauge this symmetry? So I would like to think of this equation, D0O minus DI DJ Oij, as something that replaces the notion of a symmetry. Because I don't have the charges. I don't know what charges mean in this thing. This is a local differential equation. But I would like to say, what does it mean to couple that to fields? So first, we couple that to background fields. And the rule is very simple. Every operator that you see, you couple it to a source. If you look at your standard textbook thing, that's what they tell you to do. Every operator that you have, you couple it to a source. And then what this differential equation means is that different sources give the same answer. And specifically, if you shift A0 by D0 alpha and Aij by Di Dj alpha, these terms are not modified because of this differential equation. So this is kind of a generalized gauge symmetry. Alpha is an ordinary U1 gauge parameter, but the gauge fields are A0 and Aij. There's no connection for Ai, but instead there's this symmetric tensor. Such structures appear in the condensed matter literature, especially in these papers and some others. So we follow our nose. We took this original system. We coupled it to gauge fields. We identified the gauge symmetry. There's no ambiguity here. So we can write gauge invariant field strength. Kind of funny with all the derivatives and the indices. I don't expect you to follow the details, and they are not important. The important thing is that I interpret this equation as a generalized symmetry, as a generalized global symmetry, and I gauge it by coupling every operator to a source, and then reading off this equation means that there's some redundancy in the coupling to the background fields. And then I have some electric and magnetic fields that are gauge invariant, and now I can add to the Lagrangian E square and B square with some coefficients. And this is the system. And this is my take on what these people were talking about, though they don't quite state it in this form. So what's the summary? Sorry for going a little bit over time. Very much over time. No. Oh, not too bad. Not too bad. So the last part was a little bit fast. At the beginning, I went slowly so that at least you see the starting point. The rest you can just work out on your own. So I presented the hierarchy of three global symmetries whose charge, Q, carries a spatial vector index. That was the goal. My goal was, can we find a system? What do we mean by a symmetry that has a vector index? And for every one of the three examples that I discussed, it was based on some U1 gauge theory, either in the continuum or on the lattice. And depending on which matter system I couple it to, I have the three different kinds of vector symmetries. And we showed concrete examples of these matter systems. So there's a defining equation with these O's. And then we showed some concrete examples with some scalar fields. And then we gauged the systems. And as we gauged the systems, we needed some BMU and also some symmetric tensor with all of its peculiarities. And I emphasized that all this was really forced on us from the defining equations of the matter system. Now, this can be generalized. This point of view can be generalized in many ways. I've actually generalized it in many, many different directions. And some of them, they are counterparts in the condensed matter literature. Others, I have not found in the condensed matter literature. There are many questions that can be done. I'm way on my way to extend all that for discrete symmetries. So it's clear that there's not going to be currents. So here I use the currents heavily to guide me, because there were local operators that satisfy some differential equations. But the charges, these things on manifolds and so forth, these things do exist, which very much that's what we do with ordinary discrete symmetries. The current, the net current is not there, but the charge operator is there. And this can be generalized. And now, whether this has anything to do with fractons, I don't know. But this is my understanding of some of the fracton literature. And some of the fracton people might say that they knew all of it, or they knew part of it, or this is a new perspective on new things, or it's completely new. I have no idea. So I leave it at that.
Questions or comments from anyone?
So for the last theory where you reached the type of symmetry, did you try to quantize it?
Okay, so I analyzed in detail the quantization of the matter system on its own without coupling it to any gauge field. And it's very peculiar because it has a very large infinity of vacuum degeneracy, which I can't tell whether it's a bug or a feature. You might not even know where this phrase is from. Well, nobody knows.
Well, what about the last?
So if I just take the matter system as is, so forget the gauge fields, you can show that it has a very large vacuum degeneracy. So you start with vacuum, it's a first order Lagrangian, and fine phi bar are creation and annihilation operators. And you act with the creation operator, say phi bar, and you can act with as many phi bars as you want, as long as they are at different points. All of these states have the same energy, which is very, very unusual. It's a huge vacuum degeneracy. Now, if we gauge the system, couple it to gauge field, all of these states are not going to be gauge invariant. So some of them might be, most of them will not be. I've not analyzed that in detail, but there's a huge vacuum degeneracy. So you might say, this is a sick system. A system that has such a large vacuum degeneracy must be sick. And it's basically the statement that these charges are not mobile. So you put them wherever you want, and they just stay there forever, which is a consequence of the symmetry. I should emphasize that this is true even when I generalize it and I have this more generalized symmetry, where things can move a little bit. This is still the case. We have this infinite vacuum degeneracy. Now, I'm actually encouraged. I think this might be a feature rather than a bug, in the sense that fractons are characterized by having a very large vacuum degeneracy. So I do actually see that I have that. And it's interesting, so that everything I say really follows from symmetry. So you could ask, is the degeneracy a consequence of the global symmetry? And some of it is. Some of these states that are degenerate are in a representation of this big symmetry, but some of them are not. So the degeneracy is more than what the symmetry dictates, and I don't know what to make of it. So maybe this is related to the large degeneracy of fractons. Maybe not, but I think this is a correct property of these systems.
So for the last phase, suppose you remove the matter field, completely, just look at the gauge field,
yeah.
Look at the quantized and then look at the dynamics.
Then it's gapless.
And stable?
Oh yeah, this is called photon.
I mean, do you need to worry about some kind of Einstein rule?
Well, it's a U-mark, so let's stay in 3+1 dimensions. We're in 3+1 dimensions. At low energies, we have a photon, and that's the end of it.
Including the, after you gauge the dipole symmetry.
Well, which system are you talking about?
The last theory.
In the last theory, after I gauge the dipoles, I gauge everything, I end up with A0 and Aij. So if I gauge everything, I end up with A0. In Aij, it's gapless. And such systems actually were discussed in the condensed matter literature. These are theories of symmetric tensor cage fields. But it's free at long distances, and at long distances you can do whatever you want. You know. It's not relativistic, so there's no contradiction with having this Aij. But it is what it is.
And the gauge symmetry is enough to remove negative normal states.
I don't know if this, I should really think about it this way. I think there are no negative normal states here. Yeah, so for the same reason I always do. Because I'll just pick A0 equals zero gauge.
Yeah.
Instead of thinking of ghosts and covariant quantization, I'll do it in A0 equals zero gauge. And then I have some Gauss law. I wrote the electric field. I wrote a formula for the electric field, so I impose that its derivative is something or another. So that's a master. This is some gapless theory. And in fact, this gapless theory was discussed in the literature, both in the continuum and on the lattice. So almost many of the things I said have counterparts in the literature. I shouldn't get credit for it. What is new is this way of organizing it in terms of the global symmetry. So at every step, I'm very careful what's global and what's gauge. That's kind of, I found that discussion a little bit murky in the literature. I was very careful what's global and what's gauge, and I replaced, and I went after the conservation equation is the starting point. So I have a conservation equation. That means some symmetry. That's a global symmetry. And if I want to gauge it, I use this minimal coupling procedure and so forth. So that is new.
So from this line of thinking, does the symmetry have to be abelian?
If you asked me a week ago, I would have said absolutely yes, because higher form symmetries have to be abelian. Last week, there was a paper saying that it can be non-abelian. I haven't yet deciphered that paper. This was from somebody who was here before, until I think last year, Radicevich, George. So he wrote a paper, and in the abstract, he says that there is a non-abelian, or maybe in the introduction, he says that there's a non-abelian version of this. And I haven't yet deciphered it. The higher for, the relativistic higher form symmetry cannot be non-abelian for very good reasons. And these systems, these symmetries are kind of more subtle, and maybe they could be non-abelian. I'm confused even when it's Zn. So I'm kind of leave the non-abelian version to the more advanced class, not at this stage.
How can I determine whether the gauge transformation or the global symmetry is U1 but not R?
Ah, excellent question. Really excellent question. In fact, it's R. In fact, it's R. I kind of glossed over it. The gauge group is R and not U1. And that you could check by seeing how it acts on various things.
Is that important, though?
Well, locally, it makes no difference. Globally, it might. But the point of view here is that I'm focusing on local properties. Now, where will it be important? It would be important if you consider non-trivial bundles for this. But I don't fully understand the non-trivial, what it means to have non-trivial bundles of this. So I work on patch of a manifold. So let me step back. The point here was that I'm looking at the patch of a manifold and I write differential equations. So I don't care what the curvature is and all that. So just put the derivatives to be covariant derivatives. And you might need to add more terms depending on the curvature, but it should be straightforward. That by itself already contradicts what's in the literature. In the literature, they say very strongly that this thing makes sense only on flat space. So maybe I'm wrong about that. Honestly, I don't see how it could be valid. If you have a field theory that has an energy momentum tensor, it must make sense, at least for small curvature. Right? These are correlation functions of the energy momentum tensor. Now, locally, I more or less know what it means. If you try to make it global, there could be all sorts of things that can go wrong. All sorts of things can go wrong. So the exploration here is very preliminary. There could be anomalies. So far, these are kind of bosonic systems, so I don't see how any of this could happen. But there could be all sorts of more subtle things. But locally, I know what that means. Whether they're non-trivial bundles, I'm not so sure. The fact that the one-form gauge parameter that I discussed here is not a U1 gauge field suggests to me that the fancier topology of two-form gauge fields is not there. But, you know, who knows? So the good news is that the more confused I am, the better the news, because there's a lot more that can be done. It's very straightforward and very explicit, so it can be just done. And if it's good for fractons, it's even better. And if not, maybe it's good for something else.
In the spirit of yesterday.
Sorry?
In the spirit of yesterday.
Not only yesterday.
Sure, you're not sure of the segmenting for next time.